1971. With the exception of 2013 during another government shutdown, the annual gathering has taken place with another one held on Thanksgiving Day. The International Indian Treaty Council hosted the event. And during this week in 1891, people mourned the passing of Sarah Winnemucca, the first Native woman who published a copyrighted work in the U.S. Her book, Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims, was an autobiographical work published in 1883. Her birth name was Thakmetani, or Shellflower. I'm Brian Bull.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 16, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Anna Wilcox, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, Trump's and NATO's tensions with Russia increase. Of late, Donald Trump's policy in the Ukraine war is to denigrate and threaten Russia and encourage the idea that Ukraine can win. Russia is a paper tiger, he has said. He says he might authorize NATO's purchase of Tomahawk missiles so that Ukraine can strike deep inside Russia unless Putin agrees to a ceasefire. Moscow has warned that those missiles will seriously escalate tensions. And tariffs on Russia, says Trump, will end the war. But Trump's words have never meant what they seem. His administration hasn't given Ukraine any weapons aid. No tariffs have been imposed on Russian imports. The 27-member European Union was prepared to enact new sanctions on Russian banks and oil companies, but Trump intervened with a demand that the EU either immediately stop buying Russian oil or the US will not join in sanctions on Russia. That was a clever way for Trump once again to avoid imposing sanctions. He knows very well how dependent the EU is on purchases of Russian oil, purchases the EU has decided to end only in 2028. The EU has announced that starting in 2027, it will no longer purchase Russian gas. These EU decisions give Trump the perfect out. While Trump thus stands aside, two burning issues need attention. One, from a study by the Yale University School of Public Health, reminds us of Ukraine's stolen children. The study identifies 210 camps in Russian and Russian-occupied territory that house the children. Though some have been returned to their homes, other groups of children, says the study, have been held indefinitely. In some cases, children who have entered the network of camps, so-called family centers, and other facilities, have entered Russia's program of coerced fostering and adoption, eventually being placed with families in Russia and becoming naturalized citizens of the Russian Federation. Children at these facilities routinely undergo re-education and in many cases are placed in programs of forced militarization that include, though are not limited to, combat and paratrooper training. Children at some facilities have been engaged in the production of military equipment for Russia's armed forces, including drones, unquote. The other pressing issue is Russia's increasing violations of NATO airspace with drones and jets. An article in the October 2nd Economist reports, quote, since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, its intelligence services have led a campaign of sabotage and subversion across Europe. Described variously as hybrid warfare or gray zone tactics, these hostile acts occupy a hazy space between untroubled peace and open war, unquote. Lately, Russian drones have been sighted over Germany, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, not just looking around but spying on military sites and economic facilities. Russian jets have also penetrated the airspace of Poland, Estonia, and Norway. These acts present an obvious dilemma for Western governments, whether and how to respond when the acts are provocative but short of war. While some analysts say these intrusions could be accidental, officials in the affected countries are convinced the Russians are testing them. Trump seems to believe that, but has offered no public support of NATO should it decide to shoot down drones or jets. The U.S. vows to defend Qatar and gives its airmen access to a U.S. base. President Trump issued an executive order September 20th to defend Qatar if attacked. The order says the United States will, quote, take all lawful and appropriate measures, including diplomatic, economic, and if necessary, military, to defend the interests of the U.S. and of the state of Qatar. Typical of his presidency, the order ignored the need for Senate confirmation of what amounts to a defense treaty. Trump's order clearly was in response to Israel's attack on the Hamas leadership based in Doha, an attack that is said to have outraged Washington since it came amidst peace negotiations. Presumably, this commitment to Qatar will deter another Israeli attack. Netanyahu has promised there won't be a recurrence. But how will the U.S. respond if Iran or a militant group makes some kind of assault in Qatar? This and other questions about the intent and meaning of the Trump order have gone unanswered. Shortly after that order was issued, it became known that Qatar has been granted Air Force training facilities within the Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho. While other countries train their militaries at U.S. bases, right-wingers are up in arms over this decision. Right-wing influencers like Laura Loomer and local right-wing groups accuse Qatar of being a supporter of Islamic terrorism. One group, the Idaho Freedom Foundation, quote, unequivocally condemns the planned airbase, saying the decision, quote, appears to have been made without a consultation or consideration for the residents of Idaho. To unilaterally decide that Idaho will host a foreign nation's Air Force facility, says the statement, which would house and train foreign nationals whose loyalties don't align with our own national and state interests, is a completely unacceptable overreach. And the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize is Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who built a powerful social movement challenging the country's authoritarian president and has been living in hiding since last year. The Norwegian Nobel Committee praised her, quote, tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy. After being barred from running, she backed an opposition candidate against Nicolas Maduro in the presidential race. Maduro won what was widely regarded as a rigged election, and Machado went into hiding. Trump shouldn't be too disappointed about the award. Machado dedicated the award to the Venezuelan people and to Trump. She supports U.S. attacks on Venezuelan boats presumed to be carrying drugs. Those attacks now number 5, with 27 deaths. She says Maduro heads a narco-terrorist structure. Yet that same regime made an extraordinary offer to Trump in a bid to reduce tensions. According to the New York Times investigation, quote, under a deal discussed between a senior U.S. official and Mr. Maduro's top aides, the Venezuelan strongman offered to open up all existing and future oil and gold projects to American companies, giving preferential contracts to American businesses, reversing the flow of Venezuelan oil exports from China to the United States, and slashing his country's energy and mining contracts with Chinese, Iranian, and Russian firms. The deal raises comparisons with Trump's minerals deal with Ukraine, support of Kyiv in return for access to resources. Venezuela is said to have the largest oil reserves in the world, and China is its main customer. Despite this tempting offer, according to the Times report, based on extensive interviews, Trump rejected it, siding with Secretary of State Marco Rubio in taking a hard line on Maduro that might include seeking regime change. Ms. Machado is in the wings. She has been lobbying in Washington to persuade Trump, and especially the U.S. oil companies, led by Chevron, that only a democratic regime can protect and promote foreign investment. Human rights does not seem to have entered the conversation. Trump must think he can get an even better offer from Maduro's successor. In other news, America is slowly going broke. That is what David Kelly, J.P. Morgan Asset Management's chief global strategist, is saying as he looks at the U.S. national debt, which now tops $37.8 trillion, and interest payments on the debt, which exceed $1.2 trillion. Kelly says the debt-to-GDP ratio, already at 99.9%, will likely keep rising even under moderate growth. Despite tariff revenues and temporary deficit relief, he cautioned that political choices or a slowdown could quickly worsen the fiscal picture, urging investors to diversify away from U.S. assets before going broke slowly turns to going broke fast. Sanctions on Iran will be reimposed. Over the objections of Russia and China, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom voted to reimpose sanctions on Iran for Iran's failure to clarify its nuclear program. This so-called snapback provision in the 2015 nuclear deal comes as Iran's leaders have tried to sell 2 points, that Iran will never seek to have nuclear weapons, but that Iran may have to go back on that promise if sanctions are imposed. Another nuclear confrontation with Iran may be in the near future. Germany is ending arms exports to Israel, or is it? German Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced in August that Germany would no longer issue licenses for weapons clearly usable in Gaza. The economy ministry said the ban was even wider. The ministry revealed that between August 8 and September 12, no licenses of any kind were granted for arms exports to Israel. Up until then, Germany, long a major arms supplier to Israel, had approved arms exports to Israel worth about 251 million euros between early 2024 and mid-2025. Now, however, a different picture has emerged. The liberal Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports, current German approvals up to September 22nd show 2.46 million euros in shipments occurred to Israel between September 13 and 22, though the economics ministry said these are not weapons but other military goods. It seems that all the German rhetoric and criticism of Israel's Gaza war only goes so far when it comes to actually doing something about it. Next, Japan's next prime minister will be a woman. The ruling LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, elected Takeuchi Sanai as its leader, putting her on track to be the next prime minister. She is considered to be very conservative, which promises a tough line on foreign workers and the economy. The LDP, nearly always the dominant political party in Japan, has suffered several electoral defeats recently, on top of which its longtime coalition partner, Kometo, has withdrawn, citing differences over political fundraising. LDP power brokers have been moving to the right, in keeping with a new Japan First group that is making headway in parliament. Her election may also mean new tensions in relations with China and South Korea, but she might do well with Trump, since she was close to former Prime Minister Abe Shinzo, a Trump favorite. Afraid of DEI? Not in the European Union. Where you see more and more companies afraid of saying they are working on inclusion, diversity, and so on, the EU doubles down on its commitments. So said the Equality Commissioner of the EU, who is from Belgium. The EU will provide funding to national authorities and civil society groups focused on DEI measures, she said, casting the issue as good for business. When people can be themselves, it's clear they give their best, their ideas, their talents, she said. That's good for our competitiveness. Finally, some news updates. First from Israel, where we are already seeing how the so-called peace agreement, that is to say the ceasefire, might unravel. First, the joys of Palestinians who are returning home are tempered by the reality of the destruction and the extraordinary obstacles to restoring public services. Second, massive aid deliveries by various NGOs require permission to proceed from Israeli authorities. Israel has already refused to reopen the Rafah crossing as it tries to pressure Hamas into releasing the bodies of slain hostages. And third, Hamas has made clear that it will not surrender its arms. To the contrary, its forces are patrolling Gaza City and seizing people who are considered informants and traitors. Fourth, Israel is continuing military strikes in Gaza. Finally, there are many ambiguities and unpublicized aspects to the so-called Trump plan's next phase, and Trump has said nothing to indicate he knows what those are. Next, in South Korea, President Lee Jae-myung did as I expected, clarify that the deal with Trump for a lower U.S. tariff rate would not mean a direct Korean cash payment to the U.S. government of $350 billion. Interviewed by Reuters, President Lee said, quote, without a currency swap, if we were to withdraw $350 billion in the manner that the U.S. is demanding, and to invest this all in cash in the U.S., South Korea would face a situation as it had in the 1997 financial crisis, unquote. Under Trump's version of the deal, he, not the Korean government, would determine how the $350 billion would be invested. Lee's comment no doubt also reflected South Korean upset over the treatment of its workers who were detained by ICE in a raid on the Hyundai battery plant in Georgia. Still, Lee said Korea wouldn't walk away from the deal with Trump. I believe that between blood allies, we will be able to maintain the minimum amount of rationality. Lastly, a follow-up to my report on Trump's $20 billion loan to Argentina, which turns out to be contingent on the right-wing government of Javier Milei winning the next election. Imagine, here's a deal that not only takes $20 billion out of taxpayers' pockets, so much for America first, at the same time that Trump has frozen or canceled $27 billion in federal projects in Democratic-majority state districts, and not only benefits private investors linked to his own administration. The deal also directly interferes with a bribe in another country's election. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertoff. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Some 2,500 No Kings protests are planned around the country this Saturday. KBOO's Nina Mayfair spoke with Hunter Dunn from the group 5051 to learn more.
How was the decision made to focus a major national day of action on the No Kings theme at this particular time?
Yeah, so the No Kings is the theme of a large national coalition. Groups around the country, whether it's labor, whether it's human rights base, whether it's immigrants' rights, whether it's groups like 5051, whether it's there's a massive coalition. You can just go to the No Kings website and see the partners list. So getting all those people to come to the table takes a while, and it's quite the process, but we were thankfully able to make it happen. So that's okay. How it sort of gathered around it, because No Kings is a really powerful rallying cry for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Because it sort of harkens back to the founding of this country, right, in opposition to the tyrannical overreach of King George III, and connecting that to the wannabe dictator that we're dealing with now.
How do you view this protest fitting into the larger strategy of defending democracy and opposing authoritarianism?
Yeah. I think that mass mobilizations have an important role to play when it comes to resisting fascism. I'm just going to say it outright. Mass mobilizations, in my mind, have three purposes. One is building community solidarity, right? Showing millions of people around the country and even the entire world. We have protests in Western Europe, Canada, Mexico, Central America, and I recently saw one scheduled in India, which is fantastic. Getting over 5 million people on June 14th and hopefully 6, 7, 8, or 9 million on October 18th. That there is a power to having those many people exercising their First Amendment rights all at the same time together with one voice, mm-hmm. right? That's one side of it. Another side is education, getting people the knowledge and the connections that they need to take action tomorrow and the day after that and in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Getting people connected to community defense groups, to anti-ICE patrols, to mutual aid groups that are helping the unhoused or providing for people suffering from Trump's disastrous economic policies. Getting people in contact with lawyers' guilds and groups that can help protect them if ICE comes after them or if the FCC comes after them, as we saw with Jimmy Kimmel, but also saw with regular people at normal jobs. Protecting people from other forms of executive overreach that this administration are taking. Being a part of those groups, working with those groups, taking action weekly does far more than just one day could ever do. This is a marathon, not a sprint, and the mass mobilizations are sort of help with the relay race aspect of it, like helping hand off people from a mass mobilization event to those more direct community-focused actions that in the long run will have a larger impact in defending democracy. The final element is the mass non-cooperation does have real measurable policy impacts. For me, the biggest one is when it comes to Trump's illegal occupation of cities. During June 14th, all the world was standing with Los Angeles because Los Angeles was being invaded by, in Los Angeles at least, because that's where I'm calling in from the greater Los mm-hmm. Angeles area, we want to stand with Portland and Chicago the way they stood with us on June 14th, right? Showing that the people there are not violent and that the only people there who are violent are federal agitators under direct orders of Donald J. Trump.
What concrete long-term policy-shaping goals is this action designed to advance?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number, right? From a California lens, I know many people who are coming to these protests, coming to these rallies, coming to these demonstrations are going to be talking about Proposition 50. They're going to be talking about the Election Rigging Response Act, which is designed to prevent billionaire bot Republican state legislators from rigging the 2026 election. It's designed to bring the power back to the people and ensure that the will of the people, the will of the popular vote, wins out. So that's one example. But the main policy goal is always going to come back to removing this administration from office before they commit more abuses, right? Because every day we're seeing an escalation from this administration. We're seeing them commit extrajudicial murder, unlawful killings in violation of international law in the Caribbean. We're seeing them round up our neighbors from churches, from schools, from their work, and from immigration court appointments, people who are doing everything right, and throwing them in concentration camps, both in El Salvador and here. And now they're forcing them to do hard labor. So it's escalated into labor camps. We are seeing consistent escalations by this regime, which is why it's so important to stand up now, to band together now, when we are still able to do so in such large numbers, because right now they can't possibly arrest all of us. And we can build that momentum today, tomorrow, at No Kings, and moving forward, so that they lose control and lose power and they can harm less people.
Portland has seen intense scrutiny around protest safety. Could you detail the protocols and training that event volunteers have adopted regarding nonviolence and de-escalation?
I more want to be careful what I say because some of these strategies depend on us not explaining them out loud. So it's complicated, yeah. But we take protest safety, we take de-escalation incredibly seriously. We have, the No Kings Coalition has trained tens of thousands of volunteers in de-escalation and community care. And that's in addition to thousands of labor leaders, faith leaders, community leaders around the country who are volunteering at quite possibly every event, right? Like there is, I personally help with de-escalation and I help with safety in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. As a national press coordinator, much of my training, much of my understanding centers around specifically dealing with hostile press, people who are trying to shove a camera in someone's face and trying to harass them, dox them, or otherwise make their lives worse, right, at an event. And it's part of my job is to separate that hostile press from the protester being harassed and to make sure that it stays safe and to protect people's identities. In my experience, often the most effective strategy is to quickly Google the person who's shoving the camera in someone's face, because often there's things about them that their live stream found out, about half their live stream would immediately leave. Mm-hmm. Happened a few times. But there's many other considerations, many other strategies being taken. Something I can share is that in my experience, the number one risk to protesters, and this sounds silly, but I promise you the number one and number two risk to protesters are dehydration and heat exhaustion. So encouraging people to bring water and bring sunscreen is really important, and making sure that we have extras that people don't have them is extremely important. because we don't want a lot of, like, it's a risk, right? If someone faints and they fall into concrete, they could get severely hurt. So we always want to have medical support ready, and we want to have easy access to water, to sunscreen, to other resources that can prevent heat exhaustion. I know there's been a push to bring yellow bandanas. I think that's great because you can use a bandana to help protect you from the sun, and you can put water on it to help cool you down in case you're suffering from heat exhaustion. But primarily, it's going to come back to de-escalation, right? It's whether it's a far-right agitator or it's a member of federal law enforcement who would just love to shoot directly at a priest, as we saw them do in Chicago. The most important thing is finding one of those safety team members. If you see any agitation happening, right? If you see someone trying to harm someone else with their hands and someone else, harass someone else, finding a nearby safety team member and getting them involved so that they can de-escalate the situation. Most of the time that just involves putting yourself in between the protester and the agitator, right? Providing a calming presence, getting them to calm down, separating them from the crowd, mainly for the crowd safety. Again, like every, you know, in LA, we have a list of plans, routes, in case anything possible, anything that you could think of happening and things you wouldn't even think of happening, we have those plans alphabetized. So I know that every major city is taking those de-escalation trainings, having those backup safety plans incredibly seriously. And I know that in Portland, in Chicago especially, that's so important because Trump and Republican officials are going around claiming that Portland is war ravaged. Meanwhile, you cut to a live feed of Portland and you see people in inflatable frog costumes doing the electric slide. So obviously they're just making it up. But it's important to be ready because of that escalated rhetoric by this administration, whether that shows up in the form of members of Trump's cult or that shows up in response to ICE.
What is your call to action for first-time activists who are hesitant to attend, and what is the single most important safety tip you can give them?
Yeah, from 5051 especially, but the entire No Kings movement is a really broad tent. Whether you're left, right, or center, whether this is your first protest or even protesting since Vietnam or even earlier, we want to make sure we have a place for you. We want to make sure it's as safe for you as possible. But the number one way to make these events safe is by going, is by attending. Because when you have millions of people exercising their First Amendment rights together, this administration can't possibly stop all of them, can't possibly arrest all of them. Any person that they mess with or try to harm will cause immeasurable harm back to that administration a thousandfold, from the social media coverage, from the push from legislators, from holding them accountable now and giving them a fair trial once they're out of power. And all of that will be used against them, and they understand that. So if there are millions of people standing together, there's a million people across the country, and we're going to have a lot more than just 1 million. That is the best way to keep this process safe. That's the best way to make these protests effective, is by going, is by attending. On a safety tip, I would recommend that everyone brings, you don't know whether or not you're going to wear it, to bring some sort of face covering, whether it's a bandana or a N95 mask, something that you can cover your mouth and your nose with, both because there's this terrible thing called Palantir, ran by Peter Thiel and other anti-American billionaires, which they're trying to use to spy on the American people, but also to protect you in case there's a gas leak, or if federal law enforcement acts out and tries to tear gas a protest. Having that there can mean the difference between you being more or less unaffected and you having a really terrible next couple days. So I think it's really important to bring some level of personal protective equipment, whether you're just concerned about Big Brother or you're more concerned about misbehavior from people who should be defending the American people.
What is the core takeaway you hope the public and elected officials have from this protest?
That we, the American people, are standing up even when you won't, and that every elected official needs to get their act together before 2026 if they want to continue to be representing the American people. Because if we, the people, are standing up and you won't, that's going to be not great for you electorally. That's not going to be great for you in the future. But more importantly, much more importantly than that, because there are elected officials that are making a difference, people like many members of the California legislature who are forcing ICE to wear to take off their masks, or trying to protect us through Proposition 50, as we talked about, and other representatives around the country, like Bernie Sanders is a good example, or candidate Graham Plattner, who I think is making a really good effort to try to represent the American people and trying to stand up against Trump. The most important thing is that we, the American people, will not be silent, and we will not let you continue to destroy our country and our democracy. We care more about our neighbor than you care about that billion-dollar donation from the Koch brothers. And we will stand up for it, and we will win.
Is there anything else you'd like to communicate to our audience about this event or your organization?
Yeah. To find your local No Kings event, go to nokings.org. And from there, you'll be able to see the listing of the over 2,500 events already registered, and you'll be able to find the one closest to you. See you in the streets.
That was KBOO's Nina Mayfair speaking with Hunter Dunn from the group 5051 about the No Kings, about the No Kings protests planned around the country this Saturday. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information